could argue that secret societies that practice mystical and magical rites could very well fall hand in hand with what we understand cults to be in this day and age. And some societies may even predate the first known cult. In a lot of ways, these practices have paved the way for empires to rise or new countries to be founded. They are the cusp, the border between madness and idealism. We see a lot of their beliefs in hindsight as crazy and radical, but what else is behind it? Has our society benefited from their existence at all? And yes, I'm asking about both cults and secret societies. Were they close to some sort of divine or paranormal truth? To gauge any of this, we need to go back to the beginning, to the era of the Greeks and the ancient Egyptians. Hey guys, welcome back to yet another episode of the podcast that haunts you in your sleep. The Haunted Detective Podcast. I'm your favorite host, Kelsey Childs, but everyone calls me the paranormal Sherlock Holmes.
And I'm your favorite co-host and skeptic, Pamela J.
You're my favorite gonna make me mad today person.
Oh shit. Really?
I go into recordings and I'm like, God.
Pam's just gonna ruin this.
It's gonna ruin my day again. God damn it.
My little nightmare.
You know what? Actually, it's not the podcast that haunts your dreams. Pamela is my personal sleep paralysis demon, so.
I'm in your walls.
Well, without further ado, I'm gonna not check my walls tonight. Let's open the case file on season 4, episode 2 of Paranormal Cults.
Whoop whoop.
Contrary to what we know of cults today, the meaning of the word comes from the early 17th century and meant to care, cultivate, or worship. In the mid-19th century, the meaning shifted to speak more towards devotion, whether that was towards a person, deity, or thing. The extreme practice that is cult-like in nature can be seen as far back as the Egyptians, but from what experts know, the first organized cults can be traced back to ancient Greece. One of the primary examples that I want to talk about is, depending on who you ask, very disturbing. I say it like that because most of their practices were hidden from the public eye, making it hard to gauge what exactly happened within their sect. But there are a few things that we know for sure. Pamela, are you ready for more Greek mythology?
I'm always ready for more Greek mythology.
Okay, so the Eleusinian cult worshipped Demeter and Persephone and their reunion as mother and daughter. The mythos behind Persephone is actually quite brutal, at least the one that the cult followed. And yes, I'm aware that there are dozens of variations of this myth, but for this one, I'm going to issue a content warning. With the permission of Zeus, Hades raped the goddess and brought her to the underworld. Her mother Demeter then went to the mortal realm and told the Eleusinians to build her a temple to destroy her gifts to the earth. As a result, crops started to die, which caused a great famine. Zeus wasn't happy about the suffering that this caused in the mortal plane, and the only way to fix it was to bring Persephone home and make Demeter happy again. As ordered by Zeus, Hermes went down to the underworld to convince Hades to bring her back. Shockingly, to everyone's surprise, he obeyed Zeus's commands and let her go, but not without a caveat. In one last swift act of manipulation, he gave Persephone enchanted pomegranate seeds that forced her to return. But in a moment of mutual agreement and probably desperation from Demeter, her and Hades decided that Persephone would return to the surface during spring and summer to be with her mother, and for fall and winter, she would spend her days with her now husband, Hades, who, in all of the myths, she did learn to love because he treated her like a mutual, unlike other people in other gods in other realms. So I guess that's kind of a plus side to end this myth, I guess.
Greek mythology is so fucked up.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Poor Persephone.
Oh, Hades was also her uncle, by the way.
Oh, my God. Yeah, just throw some fucking incestual shit into the mix. Ugh.
Most of what we know about the Eleusinian Mysteries cult's formation and this rendition of Persephone's mythos is from the Homeric hymn. When Demeter goes to Eleusis to search for her daughter, she rewards the city for their help by showing herself as a goddess and sharing her secret rite. So that's basically how they came about forming the cult, I guess, is like, oh, Demeter trusted us, and therefore we must worship her and Persephone every single year now.
That was okay. So basically, they're saying that this started because she showed herself, like, as a higher power.
Yeah, it started because she taught them this sacred ritual, I guess, which was she.
Okay.
So she showed them her items.
What did she symbolize exactly?
So Demeter is the goddess of the harvest, basically grain and bread, fruits and vegetables. She is Mother Earth, technically, I guess you could say, because she also represents the nourishment and growth of the earth.
Okay. See, I could understand like a celebration of her then, since she represented something very positive and she represented a necessity.
Well, celebration, I wouldn't go that far.
Was it not?
Well, let's get into it.
Okay, I'm guessing it's not. I'm guessing it's must something a little bit more sinister than that.
During the start of the rituals, which takes half a year to prepare for, the priestesses of Persephone and Demeter walk to the temple of the goddess in Athens, with objects of Demeter in tow carried on their heads. Thousands, like thousands upon thousands, gather to watch this voyage. But if anyone were to divulge the secrets of Demeter, they would be sentenced to death along with all those unworthy who knew.
Hmm.
Really? That's all? Just hmm?
Well, I figured there was more.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there's a lot more, but I'm shocked.
Well, I just meant in the way that you the way that you sounded to me, I was just like, okay.
I thought it was going to be something like, what? Put to death? Horrible. Horrendous. I'm Pamela. I hate death.
It's really hard for me to be surprised on this podcast. We're at season 4.
9 days of rituals would then commence, which is how long Demeter looked for Persephone. The first 5 days were a series of purifying acts such as animal sacrifices and fasting. On the 5th day, the priestesses would return back to Eleusis with thousands of potential initiates following them. After this, the mysteries would become, well, more mysterious, I guess one could say. Those chosen to follow the priestesses would reenact Demeter's hunt for her daughter and wander around in the dark disoriented. They were given Kaikian, which was a drink that experts speculate had hallucinogens in it. Part of the ritual was theorized to have involved the murder and rape of a woman to honor what Hades did to Persephone, but nothing is confirmed. But what we do know is that the witnesses of whatever this final act was, whether it was rape, murder, or something else, scared them so badly that they were left completely shaken up. Some of them even said that they lost all fears of death during the mysteries.
I cannot relate to losing my fear of death.
Oh, no, never. Me neither.
I'm petrified of death.
Sometimes I lay awake at night and stare at the ceiling and cry that life is so final.
Dude, I know. And like your chest kind of tightens and like you like start breathing kind of fast and you can't really like calm yourself down because you just have to be okay with the fact that it's an inevitable fact.
Yeah, pretty much that. Also,
So anyways,
whatever they must have witnessed was horrendous. I mean, unless you're witnessing death and seeing someone's spirit go do-do-do-do up into the heavens, I don't see how you would lose that fear if you had it in you, you know?
Yeah. I guess I would, like, I assume that they lost the fear because maybe it was something telling of the afterlife? I don't know.
I don't think so. I mean, they were scared. You know, they were shaken up.
Yeah, that's... I don't know what the fuck they saw, and I really don't think I want to know what they saw.
So on the 9th and final day, they would walk back to Athens. But here's the thing. The cult was in existence for 2,000 years.
Holy shit.
Holy shit is right. This is an interesting example because a lot of their practices have managed to stay a secret even after thousands of years and 2,000 years in practice. It makes me wonder if the people of Eleusis actually met the goddess and that's what kicked this sick tradition off. There are a lot of mythological stories like Persephone's, as we know, Greek mythology is fucked to shit.
Yeah.
But most of them didn't result in a cult to form around the deity's honor and suffering.
That is true.
Throughout history, though, there have been many practices veiled just like this one. I think they met the goddess. I think they met Demeter.
If they met Demeter, though, wouldn't they talk about it?
Well, they did.
Well, I meant, would you want to keep it a secret?
Well, yeah, you're meeting a goddess.
I mean, is she telling you to keep it a secret?
Yes. Yeah, that was a big part of it.
Oh, well, this seems really sketchy.
Oh, Pamela, come on. Just for one, just be like, wow, Kelsey, you're right. You're so smart. You're my favorite smart person. Wow. Maybe they did meet her.
I never said that you're not smart. I'm just saying.
What's that, Pamela? What's that? Oh, you think that they met the goddess? Wow, crazy. Case closed. We're done here.
If you twist my words, I swear to God. All I'm saying is I think that maybe someone pretended to be her.
So there are a lot of other, I guess, weird examples like this, and not all of them are cult-like. I would say that a lot of what we're going to talk about today falls more into line with secret societies and sketchy stuff that could be considered a secret society, but not officially. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Good. I'm glad we think alike, because I feel like any of my other friends would have been like, what are you talking about? What, a secret society, but not? Like, Kelsey, that makes no sense.
It's clear as mud. I understand.
Wow. Anyways.
I'm just kidding.
Sacred mysteries are a really good topic when it comes to this. They're described as paranormal occurrences that can be caused by a divine being or religious belief. Most of these practices have something called a mystagogue or hierophant, who is the keeper of secrets and teacher to others who are dubbed worthy to learn. You see the, like, similarities there?
Yeah. Obviously keeping everything a secret, and that being, like, a really big main focus. But also the part where they're like, are you worthy of being a part of it? Makes me think that there's maybe initiations of some scary, spooky stuff.
You heard it here first. She thinks there's initiations of scary, spooky stuff, guys. Well, you're not pretty far off base with that one. You know what they say, secrets are no fun. Unless they're shared with everyone, or if you're in a secret society.
That makes sense.
Oh, I'll see myself out.
I'm head out.
I'm gonna leave.
We're gonna go. Thanks everyone for listening. It's a great episode. We really hope you enjoyed it.
Mysticism can be traced back to similar beliefs. Mysticism and its original intention comes from the ancient Greeks, much like most of our early examples of bizarre religious practices and cults. Its meaning was to inform or teach, but that soon evolved into the embodiment of a deity. This idea of spiritual practice and mystery paved the way for some secret societies to form and thrive, specifically esoteric ones. So one could argue that alchemy falls pretty directly into line of sacred mysteries and mysticism. I love alchemy.
Oh, alchemy.
Remember how I mentioned that some of these bizarre secret societies paved the way for creation, while some others teetered on the edge of madness?
Mm-hmm.
This practice can fit into all of these categories. So, Pamela, what do you think about when you hear the word alchemy?
When I hear alchemy, I think of just natural philosophy.
Okay.
That's really all that comes to mind because that's just what I know from, like, learning about it. I know it's just a branch of natural philosophy, but I know it's, like, philosophical. It's, like, proto-scientific tradition.
Yeah.
I know it was practiced in, like, various parts of the world, like India and China and Europe.
Yeah. Basically, immortality, unimaginable wealth through the creation of gold, macabre and very secretive practices. If I were to add anything on to what you just said, it would be those things. Some people would describe alchemy as a practice that melted magic and science together, but no one knows what the word itself means. The origin of the practice has remained a mystery to this day, but I think it's kind of cool because chemistry, that word comes from alchemy. With that being said, experts believe that the word alchemy could come from Kemet, which in Egyptian meant black earth. This refers to the fertile soil of the Nile, which was basically the life source for people in ancient Egypt, which is exactly where alchemy comes from.
So it got its name from the Nile?
Yeah, from the soil of the Nile, which fertilized all of their crops. And basically, like I said, it was their life source. So it would make a lot of sense, but that is still just a theory.
Oh, okay. But that is really cool.
Yeah. So the Egyptians had a funny way of experimenting with this magical science. They definitely were inventive and innovative with their use of it, like when they learned how to refine metal ores or use dyes. But at one point, they wanted to create gold and tried to do so by painting the yolk of an egg on top of lead. It looked yellow, but much to their dismay, it was not in fact gold.
They're like, this is good enough.
Yeah, this is great. We can sell this. We're rich now.
This is close enough. Here you go. $5,000.
That's kind of entitled of you to think that they used US dollars, but okay.
Oh my God.
they actually didn't have currency. They had a trade and barter system. So ha, beat that.
You could have just said that. Here's my goat. Take my goat.
Bah. One of the most famous alchemists was a Gnostic mystic named Zosimos of Panopolis. The practice of Gnosticism is fascinating in itself. Basically, they believed that each person held a piece of God within them, a piece of divine essence, you could say. But to them, God was imperfect, as were we all. In some mythos, he is even portrayed as evil. Their main mission was a yearning, a hunt for higher knowledge that could be revealed to a worthy person who has faced God. But this knowledge is said to be within them, within all of us, actually. Zosimos, like his practice, was an interesting guy. He wrote the Kirik Metta, an alchemical book which in Greek translated to things made with hands. He was also the first one to publicly describe alchemy. But this wasn't just a science to him. He saw it as a path to spiritual freedom or forgiveness, salvation, as some may say. There were two sides of this to him, the physical form, which followed the rules of demons, and the sacred form, basically the chemical science essence that would lead one to salvation. It gets weirder, though. He also believed that humans were enslaved by demons, and it was the job of alchemists to work with, quote, material substances, as it is usually referred to, in order to extricate mankind from these entities. Through this, the Egyptians and Israelites were given wisdom and prayer that was unaffected by the demons. But these dark forces guarded secrets for the alchemists to uncover. Priests who fed them with human sacrifices were given the secrets as they were deemed worthy by the demons. I don't know about you, but I would love to be deemed worthy by a demon. That's like a high honor right there. Low honor?
Oh, for the love of God.
Low honor? High honor?
There is that human sacrifice, because if you sacrifice a fucking human, you are deemed worthy. No. Stop it. Get some help.
Just to clarify, I didn't mean I was going to sacrifice a human. I just meant that.
No.
Imagine just like walking around being like, yeah, man, the demons last night, they told me I was worthy and they gave me some hard ass secrets, man.
Wait, can you say that again? Into the microphone? Into the wire? The cops are listening. No, but I'm not surprised that they had to do something heinous, like to be seen as worthy.
There's so much more that goes into this. A lot of religious technicalities from the time, like King Solomon, who we spoke about last season. He was seen as a sorcerer who had divine control over these demons through exorcisms, which was carried through to the Freemasons, who we will talk about soon, and Knights Templar.
Oh, the fucking Freemasons.
But the most interesting part of this story is the fact that he held first mention of the Philosopher's Stone.
Harry Potter?
Actually, it does leak into Harry Potter a little bit. We're not going to be talking about it, but
I know.
I guess I'll mention that Nicholas Flamel, who was a real person outside of Harry Potter, he lived in like the 1300s in the Middle Ages. He actually was the first one to directly reference the Philosopher's Stone, but everything else about his existence is just kind of a mystery, and there are a lot of guesstimates about who he was, but a lot of people believe that he wrote the book on alchemy, which is how he ended up in Harry Potter as this like 600-year-old dude. And yes, he had the very same wife in real life.
That's actually so cool. And that's really fitting for Harry Potter too. And I don't know. I like that. That's cool.
Okay, so this one is a doozy for sure. The lore that is behind the magical substance that is the Philosopher's Stone, which is not actually a stone, mm-hmm. is so absolute and generally believed in that it has made appearances in various TV shows, movies, and books. If you've ever seen the horror movie As Above, So Below, this is what they find around the end of the film.
Oh, shit. Okay, I didn't even realize that.
Basically, it is something that would allow those who are well-studied and researched in alchemy to turn anything into a pure metal like gold. It is also referred to as the elixir of life, as it grants immortality. It's basically something that creates perfection. The Philosopher's Stone wasn't actually a stone, it was an essence, a divine substance that could be created, because it was thought that every stone or material was made up of mercury and sulfur. Therefore, you can find perfection by transmuting those materials.
Oh, shoot. So, like chemistry.
Ding, 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 ding. Shall I say that the Middle Ages was the golden era of alchemy? Haha, but But yes, by the Middle Ages, the practice of alchemy became more of, I guess, a secret society. Yeah, sure, they wanted to be able to create gold, but the main goal became about revealing the secrets of creation. They saw everything as interdependent, connected through the secret of life. In the lab, alchemists were set on creating things like gold and finding out the secret of life. On one hand, they're making gold. On the other hand, they're like, we're going to solve everything. Everything is solvable. Everything is, we can reveal it all. But I want to know, what if they did replicate the manner of our creation as well?
That's horrifying. I mean, horrifyingly fascinating, but nonetheless horrifying.
Did someone say Jurassic Park?
Shut up. Rawr. I don't know why that's what I think of.
Rawr.
Rawr.
Rawr. Ooh-woo.
Oh, fuck.
Well, hey there, Pamela. I was just thinking.
No. You're going to jail. I'm calling the FBI.
So we're seeing a pretty common theme here between our two episodes thus far. Immortality and creation. We yearn to be eternal like the very gods we worship and understand that which they cannot tell us. We want to be privy to secrets and then keep them as tightly as the universe has. Secrecy has been a foundational truth that we have existed in for hundreds of thousands of years. It's what gives some cults and secret societies so much power over their followers. The craving of divine knowledge, of a closeness to one's God, of the eternal source that will make someone undying, whether on earth or in heaven.
That's insane.
It's all one and the same. We talked about human sacrifice last episode, and I think that we have much to discuss with that topic. But first, I want to explore, much like alchemy, where the lines of cult and secret society have blurred.
I think everybody knows that there's commonalities between cults and secret societies. Just for the reasons of they're both secret. You know, they're both secret. They both involve people who consider themselves elite or better than everybody else. There's usually some type of initiation process, or at least things that involve you seeming better than everybody else, like you seem like you're better than everybody else. So whether that is like your social status, how much money you make, I don't know. It depends on what cult or secret society that you're talking about. But I mean, it could be academically, like people that think they're smarter than everybody else.
You know, I think it might be, I know we're going to talk about the Freemasons. What do you think about doing next season just on secret societies?
I would love that because there's so many to cover, like so fucking many.
Oh my God. Yeah. I love Hermeticism and the Golden Circle. That's so freaking cool. But anyways, yeah, I think you're right. I mean, like you were just talking about it. I was like, oh my God, there's just so much to talk about. From the era of alchemy, mysticism, and secrecy arose another group of men who believed to hold religious or societal prowess. Even though the exact origin of the Freemasons is a mystery, the first mention of them came about in the Regius poem, which was printed from an older writing in 1390. Because of this, they became associated with the descendant of Cain, who the biblical figure, the mark of Cain, murdered my own brother, bad dude, wah.
Oh, the like Cain and Abel?
Yeah. Also known as the Children Lamech. Experts believe this to be proof that the Freemasons formed in the Middle Ages, as their symbolism comes from this time as well. They started as the Stonemasons Guild, a group that would travel from one church under construction to the next and use handshakes and other means of communication, like passwords, to prove who they were. They were also unique for their time as they provided education for their members and funded injured stonemasons or their widows or kids. This makes them the oldest fraternal organization in the world. Although, the intention of this guild seemingly shifted and the members inducted did not have to be masons by trade or at all. I'm not really sure how we got there, but it went from like, yay, we build stuff with stones and stuff, we're cool, we have a guild, to like, we are men, we have power. I don't really quite grasp how we go there, but whatever.
Someone fucked it up.
They went from, yeah, we're going to sponsor our workers and pay for their widows and kids when they die or pay for their injuries. We're so cool. We educate them on liberal arts like Latin, how to read, how to do math. And now they're just like, oh, secrets, man.
Power.
Power will be mine. This isn't even my final form.
More power. Is it really shocking? It's not.
No, it just started off so good.
It was wholesome, and then it wasn't because of shitty people. As always, gotta ruin it.
Technically, they are not a secret society or a cult, but there are some pretty nefarious rumors and allegations surrounding them that could make someone think twice about labeling this guild. And I put guild in heavy, hard, confined quotes because I would not call them a guild. And if I go missing, if me or Pamela goes missing after this episode, just go to your local Masonic temple and be like, where are they? Give them back. We need them.
I know they're here.
They're literally the only reason I get out of bed in the morning and drive to work because I turn on the podcast. Like, give them back.
They keep me entertained on my drive with people cutting me off. They give me a sense of happiness.
I didn't have any more road rage because of them. Give them back. Yeah, that's
they
what
cured my sadness.
You guys are literally going to have to do that. Anyways. The thing is that the Catholic Church, who is, I would say, a lot more sus than these dudes, they forbade their practitioners from being Freemasons, first condemning it in 1738. And the thing that might surprise some people is that the Freemasons aren't necessarily followers. Well, they're not allowed to be, but either way, they're not followers of the Bible or the Catholic or Christian God. As quoted by history.com, while Freemasonry in itself is not a religion, all its members believe in a supreme being or grand architect of the universe, end quote.
I've heard that phrase used before.
Grand architect of the universe?
Yes.
Yeah, I say it to you every day. I'm like, Pamela.
Every morning. She texts that to me every morning.
I'm the grand architect of the universe. Let's get into the meat of their weirdness. The first story comes out of Batavia, New York in 1826, when the Freemasons presented themselves as a political party. Yes, that actually happened. We'll get more into that a little bit later. On September 12th, a local drunk named William Morgan, who was described in most historical writings about him as a vagabond, threatened to write a book and expose the Freemasons for what he claimed they were, a deranged society with ulterior political tactics well-versed in manipulation. That's not a quote, by the way, guys. I'm filling that in, okay? Thank you. Things got dicey from here, and the local Mason started harassing William, trying to bully him into silence. The story goes that after being thrown in jail for exaggerated reasons, William was bailed out by a few local Masons who carried him away from the prison where he was never seen again. I don't think I have to say it, but
They killed him.
They killed him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That guy was spilling all he was airing out their dirty laundry, and they were like, aha, no. Come here.
what my question is, like, I get it. He was the local drunk. He was described as, you know, he dragged his family around from one town to another. Every time a venture of his failed, he would start another one and yada, 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 so on and so forth. But even being like that, you're people have brain cells, even in 1826. That's so rude. I'm so sorry.
Brain cell.
Don't threaten to write the book. Write the book, give it to your wife, and then tell them you've written the book and you will release it. If it will be released by a third party if anything happens to you.
Yeah.
Like the hell.
Well, I mean, he probably just wasn't thinking that, like, thinking that far. Like, I think he was just like, fuck you guys.
I don't know, man, because it's like it's described in all of these historical writings, I guess, as him infiltrating the Freemasons and the Masonic Temple in Batavia. So he was, I mean, for one, it doesn't take much to infiltrate a sect like that. I get it.
Yeah.
I infiltrated the Flat Earth Society on Facebook in 2016, gained their trust, and then started spreading bullshit conspiracy theories. But that was Facebook. This
for
is
fuck's sake.
an actual society.
Oh, God, I'm so proud of you.
This was before everyone started joining it. So I probably did something similar to what William did. I don't know. I like decided to start naming items around the room and I created a conspiracy theory. I'm like, did you hear about the Mott's juice agua incident of 1863 and 1306? It proves everything you guys are talking about.
OMG, I totally have heard of that. Mott's agua.
No, I got message requests of people being like, tell me. What is it? Give me the information.
Give me the fucking tea.
And so I would message them back and be like, I can't. This isn't a secure server. And they'd be like, no, I won't tell anyone. I'm using a VPN. I'd be like,
I'm using a VPN.
I don't know. I can't do that.
For Facebook? You're using a VPN for fucking Facebook where your name is attached to a profile? Oh, for fuck's sake.
I wish I could find those messages, but a lot of the accounts are deleted, and I think they were probably part of the crew that stormed the Capitol, and the DHS took away their social media privileges.
DHS. No social media for you. You've lost your privileges.
I have a question.
Okay.
Do you think the Freemasons protect their own?
Most likely, yes.
It's London, 1888, and the streets are a dangerous place for women. Five were just murdered, their bodies mutilated and organs ripped out. No one knew who was doing this until a letter was sent to the media with half of a preserved human kidney packaged alongside it. It read, "From Hell, Mr. Lusk. Sir, I send you half the kidney I took from one woman, preserved it for you. The other piece I fried and ate. It was very nice. I may send you the bloody knife that took it out if only you wait a while longer. Signed, catch me when you can, Mr. Lusk."
Wait, are you talking about fucking... Is that Jack the Ripper?
It is Jack the Ripper.
Wait, are you insinuating that he's a Freemason?
Maybe.
Shut the fuck up. Wait a minute. Wait. So you're saying that Jack the Ripper was a part of the Freemasons and that the Freemasons protected him, and that's why we don't know his identity?
Okay, calm down. We're not there yet. First, let's get into a little bit of what he did. Okay.
He was a jerk.
Anyways, Jack the Ripper's first victim was Mary Ann Nichols. Her body was found on August 31st. Her throat and stomach had been sliced open, although there were no other offensive or defensive wounds on her. The murderer had laid bare her internal anatomy before putting both of her hands at her sides.
When you say there's no defensive or offensive wounds, like, what does that mean? Like bruises or something?
Yes. Basically, the only thing that he did to these women was, or the next couple we're going to talk about, was he sliced their throat open, sliced their stomachs open, and just kind of posed them with their hands at their side. So there were no marks on their faces, none on their hands. Everything was perfect other than what he did.
What the fuck? So I guess they weren't facing him, or maybe they were. He was just far enough away.
I don't know.
Or close enough.
It's a good question.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they were all prostitutes.
Yeah.
So it's also possible that he was one of their clients, or they were meeting him as a client. He slit their throat before they could do anything and then did everything post-mortem.
Yeah. I was going to say, because that would make sense if they didn't try to fight him off, that either they knew him or that they felt like, I guess not safe, but like they felt fine. Like they didn't feel like they were in danger.
The second victim was Annie Chapman. Her body was found on September 8th in the same state as Mary's. On September 30th, the fourth victim, Catherine Adowes, was found after the body of Elizabeth Stride was discovered.
God, he just hated women.
But something was different this time. Other than there being two women in one day, Jack the Ripper had changed his methodology and mutilated her face as well. While the other women hadn't a scratch on them other than the brutal cuts to their abdomens and throats, he had carved symbols on Catherine's face that resembled that of the Freemasons and the carvings in the stones at Solomon's Temple.
Oh, why did I not know that?
What it looked like was a pair of compasses, which was one of the, I guess, logos, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
For the Masons. Along with this, there was one triangle below each eye that resembled the Eye of Providence. This was a Masonic symbol that represented the Creator being all-seeing and all-knowing. To further the mystery, Jack the Ripper had taken an apron that she was wearing and discarded it nearby with the message saying, "The Jewess, J-U-W-E-S, the men that will not be blamed for nothing." This was apparently, I don't know how much truth there is to this part, this was a knock apparently, as the commissioner at the time, Sir Charles Warren, who grew to fame with his actions during an excavation in Jerusalem, this letter apparently symbolized the Masonic nickname for him, which was Jewess.
What the fuck?
And apparently, he told the other authorities to wash away that letter and make it disappear. Here's where things got dicey for investigators, though, to basically back this up, right?
Yeah.
Because some people might be thinking, oh, they're just the Masons. Like, there are hundreds of them. Why not just go and, you know, talk to the Grand Master, Grand whatever they're called, and say, hey, one of your guys is murdering women. Do you know who it is? You know, do it in a very non-inflammatory way. But being a cop, as much as it is nowadays, back then was even more so a political thing, especially being a commissioner who investigated murders and did all of that. The Freemasons were in close relations with the royal monarch, and many kings were in the guild. I say that in quotations again. King George IV was the first British king to join and was a Grand Master from 1790 to 1813. In 1786, King William IV joined the Masons. King Edward VII became a Freemason in 1868, and the ceremony was led by Charles XV, who was the King of Sweden and Norway at the time. Then in 1919, Queen Elizabeth's father, King George VI, was also initiated into the order. All of this to say, arresting a Freemason or even interrogating one would be a very bad move.
Yeah. It would probably lead to a lot of death, I'm assuming.
I'd say good old Commissioner Warren would no longer be living.
Yeah. Sounds like they had a fucking, like, hit list.
Now, it's funny that you say that, because the next topic...
Oh, shit.
Even with all this information, you might be asking yourself, Kelsey, why do you think that the Freemasons were cultish or behaved like a secret society? Everyone knows that they existed. Well, I'll tell you. Thank you so much for asking. Other than the fact that the Masons were the first third party to run in America as presidential candidates, and the supposed murders they committed, they are also tied to a lot of political weirdness and manipulation around the world. This is where it kind of turns into a cult. In the mid to late 1900s, there was a Masonic temple known as P2, aka Propaganda Do. Their leader, Licio Gelo, was a fascist. Let's talk about him a little bit. Licio was born in Pistoia, Tuscany on April 21st, 1919, and was a part of Benito Mussolini's fascist movement. Great.
Oh, shit.
Although, weirdly enough, he was part of Italy's anti-Nazi resistance. To make matters worse, Licio also fought for dictator general Francisco Franco during the Spanish Civil War. He also supposedly worked for the CIA during World War II. It keeps getting better.
Yeah, it just keeps going and going.
Apparently, America got the help of the mafia to try to get rid of the influence of the Communist Party in Europe. In 1970, Licio founded the P2 Lodge, and when it was banned in 1981, there were 962 members, and a lot of them were influential political leaders.
Okay, I see where this is going.
One of whom was Silvio Berlusconi, who was a prime minister of Italy from 1994 to 1995. He was problematic. He used his power over the media and knowledge because he was described as a media tycoon before he was a prime minister, and his knowledge in marketing to manipulate the political climate to his favor. There were also suspicious things going on with his money that we're not going to talk about because I really don't want to go missing.
He sounds like a great politician.
Sounds like every politician.
God.
When P2 was banned, Licio ran from the authorities and ended up in Switzerland, but was arrested just 1 year later in 1982. But it took until 1998, the year I was born, to confirm his sentencing. But he was not sent to prison. Instead, he was put on house arrest for life. So that's cool. That's awesome.
He was put on house arrest for life?
Yeah, literally.
Oh my God.
Until he died recently at the age of 96, he was on house arrest.
You're kidding.
No.
Oh my God.
It's weird.
That's like an introvert's dream.
In the 1980s, Roberto Calvi, who was a banker for the Vatican, pseudo for the Vatican, he was known as God's banker, was murdered. There's a whole lot of twists and turns and labyrinth-like shit. The worm telling you to go one way, you go another way. The whole political system intertwined with the Vatican, you get it.
Not shocked.
Basically, he was found hanging under the Blackfriars Bridge. While Calvi was a P2 member, he was also the chairman for the Banco Ambrosiano, a bank linked to the Vatican and the Sicilian Mafia. Because of this, the bank's collapse is largely blamed on P2. Here's why. The initial conclusion of Roberto's death was suicide. That opinion changed to point fingers on the Mafia and then Licio, as Blackfriars Bridge is directly linked to P2, as they called themselves Fraternieri, which is Italian for Black Friars. We love some juicy, meaty stories. While one could argue that the Freemasons were at the center of societal evolution, they aren't spared when it comes to scandals and other mishaps, ones that kept them in power. I would allege that they're still cult-like in nature due to their manipulative influence and the strings that they're willing to pull. In Minecraft, of course.
In Minecraft, along with the, you know, Vatican City.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Whether that was to make someone go missing if their status was threatened or defending a murderer in Minecraft, allegedly, hypothetically.
Hypothetically, in Minecraft.
Whew. The fact that the police at the time of Jack the Ripper didn't even feel comfortable accusing a Freemason says a lot. Now, one could argue that the stories of saints and martyrs can play a direct role in these societies and cults, especially when it comes to perceived worth, creation, and human sacrifice. Specifically, people who willingly sacrifice themselves to a higher being or divine force. Next episode, we're going to be getting exactly into that. So buckle up, pull your trousers up. Mishta, pull your trousers up. Pamela, you do it better. Can you do it?
What?
You do it better. Can you do it?
Mishta, pull your trousers up. Was that German? German accent? What the fuck?
Don't forget to go leave us a nice review. I've linked our Instagram in the bio of the episode. Don't forget to go check that out. We're haunted.detective. I'm the Kelsey Childs and she's Miss Pammy J and haunted.detective pod on TikTok. But that's a lot to remember. So just go to the bio, click on the link. It's the easiest way to get to everything else. So yeah, don't forget to leave us a nice review. I'm literally holding this wire for my cloud lifter, this XLR wire. So you guys don't hear the high frequency noise that Pamela and I have been hearing this entire recording. So I think for that, I deserve a good review. I will cry.
We'll do a lot for y'all.
And you know what? Enough of those. We love this. I love this podcast. It's amazing. One star. What is that, guys?
Why are you saying you love us and then you slap us in the face?
Like, if you love us, give us five stars. Why one? Why two? Just five.
Just head over to iTunes and Spotify and leave us a nice 5-star review and a kind word.
May I have a word with you?
May I have a nice positive word, please?
Listen, just be kind, you know? And
that's all we want.
Remember, every episode comes out Monday at midnight. So as soon as that clock on Sunday, 8 strikes 12, throw off your glass slippers. You don't need that shit. You run right home. You get in your pajamas. You queue up the episode either for that night or the next morning, because we're your favorite and we love you. So
we love you.
Well, we're going to close the case file for today, but we will see you back bright and late next week.
Bye. Mishta, pull your trousers up.